Here we go.
Once again, my name is Dinah. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for coming out to hear me share my story. It's not moving. It's moving. First, I'd like to thank God, who is ahead of my life. I just thank him for so much. You know, he has really shown me a lot of grace and mercy. I'd like to thank my NA sponsor for coming with me, Carmen Jordan, who's always there to support me anytime I speak anywhere, and my sponsorship sister, Karen Woodland, who's always there too. Thank you. And my dear friend, Shaquana, whom we became real close these past couple months. Me and her mother was good friends, and we met after she lost her mother. You know, and it's just like I'm looking at her mother when I look at her. So I'd like to thank her for her support. And Mary, thank you for coming out, friend, that you're here. And I'd like to thank Sister Tina for asking me to come. And me and her work together with the Women's Spirituality Group at the Capuchin Soup Kitchen, where I'm employed at. You know, as the flyer said, I'm the resident manager at St. Bonaventure Monastery. I manage the monastery. I'm the aide to about 14 Capuchin priests, and I love my job. You know, I enjoy my job because I have to recognize them as somebody that helped me to get my life together. You know, I'm a recovering addict. I have 5 years clean from drug use. At the Capuchin Soup Kitchen, I was there almost every day. You know, if it wasn't for that place, I probably would have starved to death. You know, I should go there for showers, for food. And those priests saw me doing my active addiction and decided to give me a chance after I started getting clean. And I'm grateful for them to be a part of my life. But I'm going to start at talking about my addiction, how I actually started and get to, you know, and then I'm go down through that and then the cancer and God's mercy. I moved from Alabama to Detroit November of 1981. I came from a place where I had never used any drugs or anything. I was very popular in high school. I was a cheerleader. I ran track. I was a basketball star, volleyball star, and I lived for those things. And my junior year of high school, I moved to Detroit. One of my older sisters thought that it would be better for me to live in Detroit with her because I was raised, and all my sisters were much older, and I was in the house with four boys, and I was becoming a tomboy. So my sister told my mother she think that she's, you know, could come around them, and so I came to Detroit. When I got to high school, it was so much different than where I was from. You know, I was from a small town. Everybody knew everybody in school. And I moved to Detroit, and when I walked through the doors of the school, I was, like, overwhelmed. You know, I saw different people every day. I just didn't seem to fit in. I tried the basketball and the sports thing, and my ego said that I was too good to start from the bottom because of where I came from. I said I was a star already. But I didn't realize that those girls had played hard to win their spot where they was, and they couldn't just sit down. So I sort of drifted away from that, and I started hanging with the wrong crowd, you know, because I couldn't seem to fit in. Through God's grace and mercy, I did finish high school barely. You know, during my high school day, that's when my addiction first started to take toll, you know, hanging with the wrong crowd. You know, started off smoking weed, trying to fit in because I just felt like I had to fit somewhere. So I started that, and wasn't too long. Everything that people presented to me, I tried it. By the time I graduated from high school, I was well on my way to becoming an addict. By the time I went to college for 1 year, dropped out, and by this time, I had become a full-blown crack addict. I used crack for over 20 years of my life. I would use to say I lost my children, but I didn't. I gave them away to their dad, and I actually thought that it was okay because he's a parent too. But, you know, my children wanted to be with their mother, and I chose drugs over raising my children. Over the years of using, I became homeless. I did a whole lot of things to support my habit. Everything from prostitution to stealing, anything that I felt could, you know, even making the drug dealer my boyfriend. I eventually lost my family. They couldn't understand what happened to me. You know, the sister that they knew growing up, their baby sister, you know, they tried so many different avenues to try to get me clean, but what they didn't realize was that if I didn't want it, then it wasn't going to happen. You know, I couldn't get clean for them. On the inside, I really was tired and wanted to get clean, but I just didn't know how. You know, I was so far gone that I thought that there was no way back. So I told myself that I would die using. I lost my mother in 06. And right before I lost her, we had moved her from Alabama to Detroit. She got real sick. She was here for about 2 years, and within the 2 years she was in Detroit, I think I saw her twice. And my addiction kept me from letting her see me that way. During my addiction, I have almost died many times. I've been shot before. I've been beat up by dope guys. I've been almost stabbed because it was like, didn't really hurt me that bad, but it did punctuate me. And right before my mother passed, that's when I got shot. And they tried to keep it from her. And she overheard a phone conversation, and she it sort of tore her up. So after I got at the hospital, that was the second time that I saw her, the only time she was here. It was one time prior when she first got here, and then the time when I got shot. During my addiction, too, I caught a real bad kidney infection and almost died. I laid in a dope house for almost a month, sick, couldn't move. And someone else that was using with me didn't want to see me die there, so they called an EMS, and that was the only reason I went. And I can remember one of the nurses telling me that if I would have been a day late, then they would have been coming to the morgue to identify me. Another time, I almost died. It was an infection, too. And I was at the place where I called home, which was the abandoned house. And if it wasn't for me constantly drinking water, I would have died that time, too. And you would think that I would have came to some sense and felt that, okay, Dinah, enough is enough. Going back to the time when I got shot, when I got out of the hospital, I got shot in the hip. And when I got out of the hospital, it was a real bad winter that year. And the snow was about up to my ankle. And I couldn't get anyone to go and cop the drugs for me. So I'm on crutches. I had like 26 staples in my hip because I had to put hardware in my hip because I couldn't remove the bullet. And I had to put a plate behind my hip bone to keep the bullet from moving. And I decided to walk myself. And I walked like a mile and a half to get to the drug spot. And by the time I made it back, I had busted out majority of the staples. And I was bleeding. And a young lady that was there with me, we was getting high, and she thought it was a good idea that I go to the hospital. And I thought it wasn't a good idea. So I tied a sheet around my leg to stop the bleeding. And I got high all night. And I didn't go to the hospital till the next night. And the doctor told me that, you know, you could have bled to death. You could have got an infection and died. And he brought me some literature about drug addiction and how to get some help. And I looked him in his eyes and told him that I didn't have a problem with drugs. And I guess that it was evident the way I looked that he knew. And I still didn't get any help. I still used for years after that. When my mother eventually passed, my sister, one of my sisters had to actually kidnap me in order for me to go to my mother's funeral. We shipped my mother's body back to Alabama where we're from, and something inside of me didn't want the people that I grew up with to see me looking the way I was looking. So I wanted to just not go. But she made, I went, and some of my close friends, I knew that they knew something was wrong with me, and I decided to tell one of the biggest lies in history. I went, I was maybe 99 pounds soaking wet. I was on crutches. I was still healing from the wound. And I told my best friend in Alabama that I had cancer. And I didn't. I rather them thought I had cancer than to know that I had a crack problem. Can you imagine, during the time of before my mother's funeral, all the family was there, all my siblings. Imagine, you know, you're walking into the room and you can hear voices and everybody talking. But when I walked into the room, the talking would stop, you know, because they was talking about me. And I can remember one of my sisters that lived in Georgia was telling my siblings that lived here, if she was in Georgia with me, she wouldn't be like that. How can y'all let her kill herself? How can y'all let that? But what she didn't understand, they couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't help me until I wanted to help myself. And I wasn't ready. So, came back to Detroit and continued to use. And 10 months later, my dad died. And I couldn't face the whispering, the talking. I couldn't face it anymore, so I actually disappeared so they couldn't find me. And I didn't go to my dad's funeral. And right now, I still really haven't gotten over his death, you know, because it's like I wasn't there, and it's hard to, you know. So, that was like 2007. I used all the way up to 2010. My dad died like 2010. 2010, around my birthday, me and a friend, you started off having birthday gatherings together, but as mine used and continued, you know, I wasn't really involved in it, but I would show up. And in that year, I went, and I drank so much and used so much drugs that day that I did some things that today that I don't have any recollection of. The only way I know what happened was people that was there, the friends of mine, told me some of the things that I did. Embarrassing things that I just couldn't understand, you know, and I went to where I was living and I, like, tried to remember. And I was trying to remember so hard that my head was about to explode. And I still don't know to this day, but only by what they tell me. So that was the turning point for me. I knew that there had to be a better way to live. I was tired. I couldn't remember. And I can remember the long walk after I found out. And that was actually 4 days before my birthday, which is August 26th. In actuality, my clean day is 4 days before my birthday, but I was so loaded that when on my birthday, actually birthday, I went over there to get high because it was my birthday, and that's when they told me, Diana, that's your problem. And that's when they found out all this stuff, so that's when I decided to try to get clean. So I can remember that long walk, trying to remember. And I said, this is it. So during the times when I was using, I used to walk the street, you know, and prostituting. But then I didn't call it prostituting. I called it, I'm just walking, and in case someone stopped me for that, you know. So I was in denial a long time ago. And I used to walk past and stand up against this church. And the pastor of that church used to, they used to be coming in for Bible study. She used to always witness to me. And it seemed like every time she stopped me, I was either coming from the dope house or either going to the liquor store to get a drink. But I would, it was something that I would stand there and listen to her. And then I would go and do what I was about to do. So when I felt that I needed help, I didn't know anything about Narcotics Anonymous at that time. So I decided to go to that church. And I went there, and I didn't know anybody. I just walked in and sat in the back row. And before I knew it, I didn't even remember walking up to the front of the church. And I stood up there in front of these people that I didn't know. And I told them who I was and what I've been doing all these years. And I told them that I was tired and I didn't know what to do. And I heard someone tell me that I was in the right place, but they told me that no one said that, so. And that was my turning point. When I sat back there in that back row before I walked up, I made a promise to God that if he helped me to get clean, that I would live for him, serve him, and I'd do the right things. And he did his part. I was still shaky and insecure because I had used for over 20 years. I didn't know what to do with myself, so I went back to the soup kitchen. And I stayed there every day as if I was still using, putting job applications everywhere. Nobody was calling me. And this went on for about a month or two. So this one day I made a conscious decision that wasn't nothing changing. So why should I change? That day I had $10 to my name. I walked to the soup kitchen. I sat there. I got the tray of food. I started to eat, and I had made a decision that when I finished eating, I was walking out the doors. I was going to buy me some crack. I was going to buy a beer and two loose cigarettes. That was it. But today I know that when God promised you something, he never reneges on his promise. And I knew that he had promised me that he was going to help me because my heart was sincere. But a lot of times we take our will back from God and we want stuff to happen right now, you know, when we want it to happen. So as I sat there, one of the Capuchin friars came up to me. He grabbed me by the arm and he started to pull me away from the table. And I can remember looking up at him and I was saying, wait a minute, I'm not done eating. He wouldn't let me go, so I started picking things up off the tray that I could carry. And he took me into the back office and he walked me up, and this lady by the name of Nephra Barber was sitting at her desk, and he pushed me in and he said, this is Dinah. She's going to be a part of the EAT program, and he walks away. So I stood there looking at her, she looking at me, and she was like, well, the head man has spoken, so all you have to do is take this paper, go to consent, take the drug test. You don't have to do anything else because we say you in. And as I took the paper, I walked away down the hall a little piece, and I turned around, and I was like, I don't even know what the EAT program is. So I went back, and I asked her, and when she told me, I took the paper, I flung it at her, I walked away. What she told me was the EAT program is a Irving Garden program. I told y'all I was from Alabama. And every summer I had to work in the fields and do things every summer, garden and all that, and I didn't like it. So that was one of the reasons I was so glad my sister was coming to get me to take me to Detroit, you know, like the Beverly Hillbillies are moving on up. And that's why I walked away. But as I got halfway down the hall, a voice said, "Dinah, what else do you have? They paying you a stipend every 2 weeks. What else do you have? You're about to get put out of the boarding house that you're living in because you're not paying rent or you don't have money." So I went back, had to humble myself and go back to her and said, "I think I'll try it." And she said, "I think you will like it. It's more than just planting and doing that. We have class and we go out to places. We do this and that." And I actually did that program and fell in love with it. I actually got in my life behind the seed. I used to volunteer in the mornings to go to the greenhouse to do the watering. And nobody wanted that job, and I volunteered, and it became my thing every morning. And I used to be in the watering, and I sort of guided my life by the plant, because we had started, we seed them first, and then a couple of weeks, it started to come up, and then it's growing. And I said, "This is how my life is going." And I would go out there, and I would be watering and praying, because I was still shaky, Lord, you know. And the area where the soup kitchen is at is the area that I stayed in and used. And so all the people that I ran the street with and used with was right there. And I used to ask God, "Why did you bring me back here?" You know, people used to say things like, "I remember where you came from. I remember when you was on the corner. You think you're all this and you think you're all that." And I didn't. And I used to always think if they knew the struggle that I was going on the inside, they wouldn't do this, you know. I worked in the garden part, and they used to ask me for an extra tray of food. And I was like, "I can't do it." They were like, "Why you work here?" And I used to explain, "Well, if I go do that, then I would be stealing." And they didn't understand, so I would get cussed out. "I remember when," and okay, and I'm like, "I remember too," okay? And it was rough. The first 9 months, it was rough, you know, the people. But I can remember someone told me that sometimes the only book that another using addict can ever see or read is the me. So if I just let them keep shooting this at me, maybe they'll see the change, and that's what happened. You know, I had these people coming to me like, "Girl, you look good now. God, I wish I could do it." I have people still come up to me today and say, "You know what? I didn't use yesterday, but I know I'm not saying I'm done." But, you know, and I give them hope. I don't go back off on them and tell them, look down on them. I give them hope that they can do it too. You know, I love that place. People come to me and I'm like, "Wow, they come to me for advice." You know, when I used to be one of them, you know. So I did this program for the year. I came back the second year for internship to help train the following class that was coming in. And at the end of that, I'm like, okay, it was like a month before that ended. And I'm like, I still don't have a steady job. What am I going to do? I can't pay rent. Am I going to be homeless again, clean or homeless? And, you know, I just started praying, you know, "God, I need something." So I started working on the director of the soup kitchen, Brother Jerry, and I'm like, I need a job, and I was like, "You're the director, you can just create one, I'd do anything." And he's like, "Dinah, it doesn't work like that, we just can't create a job for you." He's, you know, I'm like, "Nobody is giving me a chance. I was like, I got a month before this program is over, can you please help me?" And he's like, "Dinah, if something come up, I'll let you know before we post it." And I like, it's like, okay. So one day, I was praying, and God let me know, "Dinah, you asked me to help you. You got to move out the way. It's not for you to do it. So I'm trying to do it." And he told me, "You're going to be employed at the soup kitchen because that's where you're needed at." But I was trying to do it myself. So I surrendered, gave up, and one day I'm coming from the farm down the street from the soup kitchen. I'm pushing the wheelbarrow, walking, and Brother Jerry passed by in his car, and then he stopped, and he backs up, and he let his window down. And I was dirty from being in the field. I had this red hat on. It was an Elmo hat. It was red hat, you know, like the face Elmo, the eyes, the nose. And he was like, "The Salina Center is hiring for a weekend position for receptionist. go over there and tell Brother Father Larry that I sent you. He said, go, just go, drop everything and go. So I literally dropped everything. I dropped the wheelbarrow in the middle of the street, and I ran all the way over. And when I get to his office, his door opened, and I run in, I'm tired. I said, I'm Brent Lyon. He's looking at me like, okay. And between the breaths, I would say, Brother Jerry, you sent me the job. We get in position here. And I noticed he looking me up and down. And he go in the store, he give me the application. And I leave with it. And I didn't know till after I got hired that he actually called Brother Jerry and said, who is this woman that you sent to my office? Do you know it's a receptionist job? She was dirty, she had this red hat on, her ass moving. So Brother Jerry told him, look, give her a chance for an interview. So the day of the interview, I went in, and sitting at the soup kitchen, if you're there every day, you will start memorizing certain things on the wall. And they had their mission statement in a frame on the wall. And I just sit there and I read so much that I actually had memorized most of it. And I used that mission statement in my interview. They shooting the questions, and there's three of them. At first, I was nervous. And he said, well, you know what our organization is about and what we uphold. What can you think you can bring to the organization? And I started giving them what they gave me on that wall. And when I finished, he was like, wow, do you know that's you? That's part of our mission statement. And I'm like, oh, yeah, is it? And they were smiling, and by this time I'm smiling, and at the end, when I found out that he had called Brother Jerry and said that, he's like, Diana, it was like I was looking at a whole different person than that girl that walked into my office that day. He said, you blew me away. And sometimes being there working now, you know, I'm not at that weekend position anymore. I got a promotion, and I had two promotions since then. One soup kitchen, and then back to the monastery. And, you know, and I'm going to share about when I got to the monastery, what the position I'm at right now. I had got the promotion to the Connor location, and I had been there 2 months. And it was wearing me down, and I kept telling God, I'm grateful for this full-time position with the benefits. I'm so grateful. But I can't handle this. It's too much. So there 2 months, and I worked from 12 noon to 7. And one day I was on my way to work, and I got a phone call from the Mount Elliott location. And the human resource lady was like, jumping up and down, where you been? I've been calling you. Can you come over here before you work? Hurry, hurry, hurry. And as I'm driving there, I'm like, oh, what have I done? And I'm looking over trying to think if I have done anything. So I get there, and she just doing a dance. Wait a minute, sit right here, stay right here. Let me go get Father Pat. You know, and I get there, so Father Pat come in, and he's like, Dinah, the woman that worked for us in the monastery, she just came to work yesterday, and she resigned. And I'm like, okay, we need somebody. We don't want to hire anybody new. We want somebody that's honest. We want somebody that's trustworthy. We want somebody that shows people respect. Somebody that can just handle us. And they start naming all these things, honesty and all this, and started to cry. And he asked me, why are you crying? Because I had never had anybody to describe me using those words. Where I came from, those words was not in nobody's mouth to describe Dinah. And that's why I started to cry. And he said, would you want the position? I was like, yes. I love those guys to death. I can come to work and I can just walk in and my face may look upside down and they're pulling out a relic. Come here, let me pray for you. And I stand there and I get prayed for. You know, for someone to ask you, how are you doing, and really want to know how you're doing. And if I say, oh, I'm okay, oh, no, you okay, just okay? And you know, and it makes me feel good. It makes me feel, worth something, because when I came from, I didn't feel like I was nobody. And there's some days now that I still feel like I can be in a certain mood, and I still feel like that. I still think that I'm that drug addict, that conniving, manipulating, self-centered, good-for-nothing person. And that's why I thank God for the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous that lets me know that that's not who I am anymore. And talking about prayer, when I got the full-time position, you know, God was putting some stuff in my life. I was sitting one day in my living room talking to my best friend. And we was just talking and laughing about, you know, girl stuff, how you get together with your best friend, you're just laughing and talking. And out of nowhere, I said to her, I said, I'm about to go through something, and it got something to do with my health. And she was like, well, where'd that come from? We talked about this and that, and you come, what? Girl, she said, are you sick? What's something wrong with you? Are you crazy? And I said, I don't know where it came from. It just felt like it's supposed to have came out. Now, before I got the full-time position with the insurance, I had never had bottom teeth. And that last infection that I talked about earlier, it came from my teeth. The dope drugs had ate them up. And it was just stubs sticking out, and it was infection that was shooting through my whole body. That last time, I almost died. And when I was in the hospital, they had to surgically remove all of it. They couldn't pull. He said if they would have pulled them out, it would have shot the poison straight through every organ in my body, and I would have died instantly. So all those years are from then until I got clean, I never had bottom teeth. I had a top denture, which I had that should have been threw away years ago, and I should have had a new one. And I had said that whenever I got insurance, from good insurance, the first thing I was going to do is get me some bottom teeth. I made that promise to myself. So when I got the full time, I got transferred to the monastery. I did that. I went to the dentist, and as they was fitting me, the dentist said, well, Ms. Brundage, how long have those two spots been in your mouth? The one that's at the floor of your mouth and one that's at the back. I said, well, I don't know. I said, well, the one that's at the bottom, at the floor of my mouth, it's been there for about a year or so. I said, I play with it with my tongue when I'm thinking or whatever. So he said, well, I have to stop doing the work on you. I have to report this so you can have a biopsy. Didn't think anything, you know, because I wasn't sick, didn't feel sick, nothing going on or whatever until I got diagnosed, right? So about 2 weeks later, they sent me for the biopsy. And they decided when they did the biopsy to remove both spots altogether. So they gave me the date to come back for the results, and they told me that we couldn't get an accurate reading. Your cells keep moving, changing, so we couldn't get an accurate result. And they rechecked me, and the one spot that was in the back of my mouth had came back. So they did the same procedure, biopsy, removed it again. So by the time I came back, I can remember getting there. Let me go back a little bit. I got there. I was there one day. I had been going back and forth so much that I got a relationship with them. They knew me on a first name basis, the receptionist and things. So there was a young lady there that came while I was there, and she was 5 minutes late for an appointment, and they told her that she had to be scheduled because they had a big fan there saying if you're 5 minutes late because of so many patients that have per day, that they have to reschedule, they can't, you know. and she cut up 5 minutes late, you know, and all that. So I knew that they really upheld the sign. So I had got my appointment tan mixed up. I went to work that day. I actually supposed to have been there at 10 o'clock, and I didn't go. I thought it was at 2:45. So when I get there, the receptionist said, well, Diana, where have you been? So I was like, I've been at work. And she was like, no, where have you been? You could have been here at 10 o'clock this morning. So I said, okay, well, let me make another appointment. So she was like, no, we got you. Mm-hmm. So I started like, oh, my God, you know, I know their policy. So I sat there for a second. So by the time I sat down, good, they came and got me. And as I sat there, one of the receptionists that worked in the back, she came in, and she usually played joke with me and all that, and she just came and stood behind me. So I turned around to say something to her. When I turned around, she would move over. And I'm like, what's wrong with you? You know, and she didn't want me to see her face because she was crying. So then the two doctors came in and sat there, and I said, oh, my God. So everything started, like, flinching then. And he was like, well, Ms. Bryan, he said, there's no easy way to tell you this. And so I said, well, just tell me. You know, so he slid the chair between my leg, put my hand there, and I looked over at the doctor that was standing this wall, and he was right down. So I knew it was something serious, you know, but I never thought it was cancer. It never came to my mind, right? So when he said it, I sat there, and he was like, well, it's cancer. So I sat there, and the only thing that would come to my mouth was, wow. Wow, I think I said wow about 50 times. And so by this time, I got a glimpse that the receptionist behind me and tears was coming down. And I said, don't cry. I remember telling her not to cry. And the next thing the doctor said to me, he's like, Diana, I just want to tell you something. He said, if you keep this attitude that you have right now, he said, you're going to be just fine. He said, we're going to take good care of you. We already made all the appointments for you. You just got to go. And he said, the difference, he said, you know, I have told thousands of people in the same room where I just told you, cancer. He said, but the difference between you and them is we had to call other staff members in the room to help pick them up off the floor. They was crying, screaming. He said, I have never witnessed anybody take it like you. So I sort of think because I had a relationship with God already that I didn't really, you know, take it that way. So when I got ready to go, they was like, we going to take you out the back way? I said, I'm fine. They were like, no, we're going to take you anyway. So they did. I went to walk out the door, and it was just going through my mind, wow, cancer. You know, I just couldn't believe it. You know, and the first thing came to my mind was that lie I told years back. And that's when I started sort of waving a little bit. I'm like, is God punishing me for that lie? So I decided, instead of going home, I decided to go back to my job, you know, because, you know, I work at the church, you know, Monastery St. Bonaventure Chapel. And so many beautiful places there to pray. So I went there and I prayed. So to go back a little bit from that point, God was dropping things into my spirit. And he told me that, and I couldn't understand it at the time, it was just little bits and pieces. And he said it wasn't about me. And I kept racking my mind, what does that mean? It's not about me. And I would make jokes to myself, like, you know, I'm the one with cancer. It ain't about me then. Who is it about, you know? And about a little after that, it came, the next line came, you haven't even met the person yet. And I'm like, okay. So I thought about the innate thing that we have in innate. They said, you keep coming to meetings and you're going to meet a stranger. The stranger's gonna be you. So I'm thinking, you know, in that realm, okay, I ain't met him yet, so is there still some changing in me that I need to do so I can meet me? But the young lady that it was, I was, one Wednesday, I was, they have a healing mass every Wednesday at the job. And after that, I was going to the human resource lady to, you know, get paperwork together, you know, getting prepared for my surgery and stuff. And, It was a lot of people there because of the healing service that was in the, they was eating, having coffee, donuts, or whatever. And as I was walking down this long hallway, I heard someone call my name. And I, when I turned around, I didn't recognize any face, no coworker, anybody, so I kept walking. And I heard my name again, so I stopped and I saw this young lady walking towards me with a big shopping bag. And I stopped and she kept coming and I asked her, I said, "What you calling me?" And she looked at me and she said, "Yeah, if your name is Dinah." And I'm still like, I don't know her. And when she got up to me, she dropped the shopping bag and she just grabbed me and hugged me. So I'm standing like... And when she let me go and we like sort of went back and looked at each other, God said, "This is her." She picked up the bag and she handed it to me. She said, "This is for you." And I was like, "What is this?" She's like, "This is for you." And I didn't look at it until I got in my car leaving and it was a Louis Vuitton handbag. All right, wow. But this young lady, she was sick also. She had a brain tumor. And it was like a disease, they said, too, where her brain was too big for her skull. And she had postponed her surgery 3 times. Every time it got close, she was scared. So the doctors had told her husband that this is it. If she postponed this, and she's going to die. And she was scared. She didn't believe in God. She had no belief in God whatsoever. So my job was to build her up so she could believe in God. That was my assignment. And when she told me this and that, so that following Wednesday, we went to a healing service together. And we sat on the front row. And she grabbed my hand. We held hands through the whole service. So when they had like 3 lines of priests and everyone in the line that, you know, get prayed for, so we went into the same line that prayed for her first. She was in front of me. And she stood there waiting on me. So when they prayed for me, the priest, his face, his eyes got watery. And prayed a little longer than usual, and he called my name out several times, like, "Dinah, you know, God have mercy," and just everything. And she was standing there actually listening to what he was saying to me. So when we walked out, she grabbed my hand and she said, "God is going to heal you, but he's not going to do it for me." And I said, "Why would you say something like that?" She said, "Even the priests are pulling for you. They are praying for you, and God is hearing them. They, you know, and they're not, they praying for me like that. You got them on your side, and, you know." And I was like, "God don't work like that." I said, "Why would you think that?" She said, "They call your name out. They was doing this." And I looked at her, I was like, "I work with these priests. They see me every day, so they know my name." And she went, "Oh," then the light came on, like, "Oh, okay." But I can remember I sent her, I texted her some healing scriptures one night. And I asked her to just keep reading them over and over, even if you don't understand them or don't know what they mean. Just keep reading them, reading them, reading them. She did that, and all week she would text me and say, "Send me more, send me more." And I'm like, "Wow." And this young lady is so built up now. She go to Mass at St. Charles every Sunday. She believed in God. She went to the Mayo Clinic and had the surgery. And she is alive and well. She was there when I had my cancer surgery. You know, God, mercy and grace was everywhere over me. I didn't have to have an ounce of radiation or chemo. They were able to get the surgery from the surgery, all of it. It was tongue cancer. That's why I always have to have mints and water. I still have problems with my tongue. They sort of messed up a saliva gland in there, and I can't really produce saliva regularly. I still have pain and numbing and stiffness, tingling in my tongue, even almost, 2 years later. And during the process of all this going on, I figure after a year, I should be feeling some relief. So I'm like, something's going on. I start feeling stuff like getting stuck here. And they kept running all kind of tests, saying, "Donnie, you fine? Is maybe here?" I was like, "No, I'm not fine." And I kept on and on and on and on, telling them something is still not right. So my cancer doctor decided to go down my throat with the scope. And he did. And when he went down, he found two lesions on each side of my vocal cords. And he sent me to a specialist, and he said that they would have to come off. So last year, it was October the 14th of 2014 when I had my cancer surgery. And then November of 2015, I had throat surgery. And God's grace and mercy was the hell of a place. Everything they told me that was going to happen, or how it was going to be, God showed me mercy. The day of surgery, actually, they was checking it every week before I had the surgery to see if they was, you know, the medication was giving me, whether they was shrinking or getting bigger. And all that time, they stayed the same size. But something miraculous happened on the day of the surgery. When they prepped me for surgery, I went under. When they got in, they had gotten smaller on their own. And he didn't have to do everything once he got in that he had to do. They said that I wouldn't be able to talk for 7 weeks, and I think it was 4 weeks. I love to talk. You know, so I'm great. You know, God's mercy, you know, just been all around me, you know. For him to give me a second chance at life, you know, the things I done been through, you know, sometimes I ask God, why me? What is my purpose? You know, I'm a active member of Narcotics Anonymous. I make meetings on a regular basis. I have a disease that there's no cure for, but I can live a life without using, right? So the 12 steps, I have to apply them in my life. And just today, I had to use them. I felt a little, when you called me today, Sister Tina, I felt like I wanted to say I didn't want to come and do this because of how I was feeling. And I need to say this, you know, in front of you guys. You know, today, I thought it was a good idea to have a drink. I felt like I wanted one. I needed one. I just wanted to escape the feelings that I was feeling. And it started last night. I made it through the night. But when I woke up today, it was, the urge was more intense than it was before I went to bed. And if it wasn't for the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous, my sponsor, other people in Narcotics Anonymous, I probably would have used today, and I wouldn't be here talking to you guys right now. I haven't been in a relationship in about 5 years since I've been clean. Because during my addiction, the other Fred has been a problem. I love men. Many men. I love them so much that I always depended on them. I never taken care of myself until 2010. The day I got clean. I always lived with one. That always took care of me, all of that. And when I got clean, I knew that it was a problem. And not only did I have to give up the use of drugs, right? I had to get away from that because the Bible said anyway, fornication is a sin. And I was doing very well until recently. I started dating a guy. He's clean too. He's an addict, recovering addict too. And out of nowhere. I just came back from Toledo Sunday night from a Narcotics Anonymous convention, and we went together. Stayed together, it was a wonderful weekend. Even the time before we went, you know, everything was good. Pretty clean. Get back yesterday, I have no idea what happened. He just decided that he didn't want to be working. And it hurt. Because I have started to get feelings for him. And he gave me no explanation, none. The car blew his phone up all night. All this and that. I didn't want to drive my car here because I had a problem with my tire. He was told me to, you know, leave your car here, drive my car. He didn't even, wouldn't answer, let me know, okay, you can't use the car now, none of that. I took a chance, prayed over my car, and I'm here. So I went to a meeting. I rode around after getting up this morning, hesitating. I would pull in front of the liquor store. I would pull off. I would ride. This started last night. I rode around last night, and I called her crying, sponsor. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just riding around, going nowhere. I want a drink. I just want to cover up these feelings. Because that's what I've been used to doing all those years, covering up and hiding. I was so hurt that I rode around crying. I just needed to know why. So I went to a meeting that he opens up in chair, right? And I was sitting there, and we pulled up, and I get out the car like, you know, I don't want to talk to you right now, you know, and it's like, then I get a text message in the middle of the night. I just don't want to be in a relationship, and I'm like, what, you know, then you search on what did I do when I didn't do it, you know, and I just didn't see it coming, you know, how can you be with me at a convention somewhere, we having a good time, we went there together, the ride home was good. When we separated, everything was good, you know, and then all of a sudden, at the end of the day, and I just didn't want to feel this pain. I didn't know how to deal with it because it had been so long since I dealt with it, and I just didn't want to feel it, so I thought that a drink would make it feel better. But the hardest thing for me to do today was tell my sponsor, my best friend, and another recovering addict that I want a drink. I want a drink. And I have drinking for 5 years. And I know what it does, you know. I know what it would do to me. And I almost convinced myself that I can drink as long as I don't go pick up the crack cocaine. And I done heard so many stories inside the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous that doesn't work. What people thought that they can do and they actually did, and before they knew it, they was in a dope house. So why did this tell me that I could do it? You see, what a lot of people don't know, the disease of addiction, it's really not the drugs and the alcohol. It's our thinking. The drugs and alcohol is just a symptom of the disease because we use it to cover up our feelings and emotions because we don't want to feel and deal with these things. So I have to really put some work in now because what this want to make me use after 5 years of being clean? So there's something that I haven't been doing that I'm supposed to have been doing. I'm supposed to have been able to take that. I feel, you know, it's okay to feel things, right? I'm supposed to have been able to feel that and not want to pick up. But as I got to thinking, it really wasn't about him dropping me like that. It really was about what other people are going to think. People have seen us together now. So when they see us apart, people are going to talk. Because that's what people do. They talk. So I'm going to have to grow some tough skin. I'm going to have to be a big girl. You know, because God has been too good for me to throw all this away. Because I could have been there a long time ago. And it's something that God has for me to do. It's a purpose. You heard me just saying he sent me there to help someone else. And see, when I get clean, it's really not about me. It's about me helping other people. If I used, I would disappoint my children. Because I have them back in my life today. And I had to work hard to get them back in my life. Because I lied to them so long, you know, telling them, you know, my dad want to bring them to visit me, I would be here. But somebody had beat them there with some drugs. And once I start using, I disappear. I can't face them. So they were so used to me telling them I would be there, then I wouldn't be there. So when I got clean, I went running to them with my arms open, and when they ran away from me, I couldn't understand it. But I had to do some work and realize that when I was using, I actually thought that I was hurting nobody but me. But I was hurting my children. So they had to see me and know that I was really finna do this thing, right? Because I done lied to them and said I was gonna do this next, and I never did. So I had to do some work. I had to surrender and say, okay, let me do this so my kids can see. And I can remember my oldest son. I took him to a NA convention, Detroit convention. The first time I took him to an anniversary, NA anniversary. And I couldn't hardly listen to the speaker because he's like, Ma, all these people used to use drugs, they clean, but this guy got on some $200 shoes, you know. And he looked at me and said, Mom, I'm so glad you found them. And he said, Mom, I know you. And when, at 3 years clean, when he said, Mom, I know you're going to stay clean. So how do you think he would have looked at me if I would have picked up today? And guess what? Today, I went to him for help. I went to my son for help. I had to go see that one, well, my other son, he's incarcerated right now. I'll be home in April. I had to go to the one thing in my life that kept me clean these 5 years. Look into his eyes and see happiness. And I know because if I were used, I wouldn't have saw happiness in his eyes. And when I got to him, he didn't know what was going on. I didn't even tell him. I just called him and said, I need to see you. And when I got to him, I grabbed him and I hugged him. And he could look in my eyes and tell him that I've been crying. And he's like, Mama, what's wrong? Did somebody die? And for me to be able to talk to my son like I talked to my sponsor wasn't easy. And I told him, I said, I'm dead on the inside today. And he looked at me and said, what did that mean? And I had to tell him. And for my 23-year-old son to look me in the eyes and say, Ma, there's many more men than him. Every time I go through it, once I get over the hump, it was all so simple. Then I had to look at myself and tell myself that I'm a woman of self-worth. I am beautiful. It's his loss. I can do good by myself. I can do bad by myself. I'm good by myself. And on the ride here, looked at her and said, I'm laughing. I really realized that I was laughing and I wasn't crying no more. And as I sat in front of her house waiting on her to get off work to come here, I sat there and I started praying. And I keep my meditation books, like my back seat full of meditation books. I just read that, grab one. And she pulled up behind me. She's like, is that you in the car in front of me? I was like, yeah. She said, are you asleep? I said, no, I'm reading. And before I started reading, I started praying for God to just, please, take this pain away. And I was just hurting because he didn't give me an explanation. I don't know. How can I kept telling myself, how can I have closure when I don't know what I'm closing? So when I prayed, he had sent a text message that I didn't even know he had sent. And when I read it, I'm like, you know what? He's right. And I had talked to someone after I left out that meeting because I couldn't stay. Because as long as I sit there and see him sitting, I ran up to me, grabbed my coat. And I came, by the time I get to the front door to get out, I couldn't hold back the tears anymore. So as I'm putting up crying, I see an older member, and the older member is someone with like 20-something years clean in the program. And I tried to suck all up so he wouldn't see me. He said, Dinah, what's wrong with you? I said, oh my God, I got to tell him. As soon as I opened my mouth, everything just... And he gave me some valid information, and he was like, Dinah, you're just going to have to take this one. And he said, you know, when we got clean, everything ain't going to be good and peachy, but you can't go and use behind everything. He said, I'm going to tell you one thing, and here's what really pulled me out some. He said, you think you're feeling bad right now, but you go use, you're going to feel even worse. He said, your man, he said, that's how the disease of addiction talks to us and tell us, cover it up, you're going to feel good with the alcohol. And see, I had to remember who I was when I was under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Y'all may look at me right now and say, oh, not her. I was a fighter. I would crack your head open. It gave me courage to do something to somebody. And I know if I would have got drunk, I would have went to his house. I would have broke out some windows. That's why I used to be. I've done that before. Out of anger. That's who I was. The disease of addiction actually would be out to kill us in any way it can. Sometimes it don't be the drug and alcohol. If it see that you don't have that problem anymore, it will attack you in an area where you're weak at. And I was weak with a man. I was so hurt that I opened myself back up to a relationship after 5 years. And then it ended abruptly within 2 months. And I hadn't felt that way in a long time. And I didn't know how to handle it. And he sent me that, the text message that he sent me was, no matter what happens in your life, you can't use no matter what. Even though I was angry with him and all that, that was the best thing he could have said to me. No matter what happens in your life, you shouldn't use no matter what. And he apologized for hurting me. Then he said that he just didn't feel like he wanted to be in a relationship. So I can't get mad at him. He just wasn't the one for me. So how can God bless me with the husband that I want if I got somebody there blocking it?
That's right.
Well, he just, I have to tell myself, he just wasn't the one. You know, but the pain is still here, but I know it's going to pass. You know, I thank God for my sponsor. I thank God for you. Before I sit down, I got to tell y'all how I got her in my life. When I got diagnosed with cancer, the sponsor that I had, I thought we connected. But the week, well, not even 2 days, I got diagnosed one day, and the next day, she dropped me. And I'm like, how can she do that at a time when I need her so much? I wanted to hurt her too. But I took an easy way out. I made a joke out of it because I didn't want to feel hurt. And I made a statement that, I'm taking an application for a sponsor. You know, it's a joke. and she heard Pat and she was like, are you serious about this person? And we met for breakfast. I didn't really know her. And it just, she told me about who she was, about her life and mine, and it, some similarities was there. And she's been there for me ever since. She, when my surgery, cancer surgery, they had to let 3 people in and see me afterwards. It was her, Karen, the young lady that God sent for me to help. She was there with my family and my sister, my brother, my son. And she'd been there. My second surgery, she was there. She'd be there for me every time I speak somewhere. She's there. I love her. I don't know some days what I would do without her, you know, and every time a crazy thought comes, I'm like, girl, can I come over to your house? Are you home? You know, because I've been running to her ever since I got into a relationship, you know, even when it was going good. My thinking was telling me that I was fearful of the relationship in the first place. So, I guess God ended because I was fearful anyway. I was looking for something to happen anyway. So I'm grateful to even be here. I'm grateful for you guys. You know, I am grateful for you guys to sit here and listen to my story. And I hope I touch somebody. Maybe you know somebody that's in active addiction that you can tell them that there's hope and there's a way out. You know, they don't have to stay out there as long as I did. You know, so I'm grateful. Thank you, Sister Tina, for inviting me. Thank you guys, Shaquana, Mary. And what's your name again? Karen. Karen for coming out. And the sisters, I love y'all. Y'all just, thank y'all for dinner. Y'all are so sweet. So sweet. You know, thank you guys for inviting me.
Thank you.
God knew I needed y'all tonight, and I sort of thank God for letting that happen today, on today, because this right here could be the very thing that helps me to stay strong.
Well, thank you, guys. I got news for you. Why don't everybody sit down for a minute? Dinah, have a seat. Can somebody get her another thing, water? Yes. More water, please. I want to thank you for, Dinah, for your honesty, you know, for sharing your story, for your courage. That takes a lot of courage to do what you did, and I admire you.
Thank you.
I admire you. I respect you. And I got news for you. You got a lot of new sisters right here in the room who are going to pray for you. You can count on it. Really, you can count on it. But I got a message from Jesus for you, okay? From Matthew 16. Jesus, you know, the disciples were out, they were running around, everything was cool, and they came back, and Jesus said, so what are they saying about me out there? Who do men say that I am? And Peter says, well, a couple of them pipe up, and they go, you know, some say you're Jeremiah, you're Elijah, you're John the Baptist. And Peter says, you are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. Okay? And Jesus says, who do you say that I am? Dinah, the Lord wants you to turn that around. You say to Jesus, Jesus, who do you say that I am, Jesus? And let him tell you. And he's going to tell you, Dinah, you are my beloved daughter. I love you. I can't help but love you. You are my beloved one. You are not an addict. You are not a user. You are my beloved daughter. And I can't help but love you. Okay? So you take that question every day. I just gave you homework. I'm a teacher. every day, you say, Jesus, who do you say that I am? And if you hear, you're worthless, you're no good, you're hopeless, that's the devil. And you can tell him, in the name of Jesus Christ, go to hell where you belong. All right? That's stinking thinking.
Yes.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay? I learned that stinking thinking. So you need to say, Jesus, who do you say that I am? And listen. And if you're not hearing it, you call your sponsor. All right?
You can call
your homework. You can call me too.
I thought
let's really make a commitment to pray for. What's your name again?
Carmen.
Carmen. And Carmen, yeah, pray for a sponsor. That's awesome. Whew.
Take a moment and pray with
them. Yes, I was going to say, let's do that.
Yes. I'm a prayer.
Let's definitely, I'm glad you said that. Yeah, let's do that.